nearer before Zod!
You can't go! All the plants are gonna die!
I'm gonna take a bath.
Bad dates.
I'll alert the media.
Boys, keep off the moors.
It's evil! Don't touch it!
The name's Plissken.
No war! Hang on!
Welcome to Vintage Video, where we're rewatching the 80s so you don't have to. We'll be reviewing every major film release of the 1980s in chronological order, overanalyzing what you've seen and spoiling what you haven't. I'm Patrick O'Reilly.
I'm Jesse Bayless.
And I'm Richard Wells.
And today we're discussing On Golden Pond, released November 2nd, 1981. It was written by Ernest Thompson based on his own play, directed by Mark Rydell, and released by Universal Pictures. Ernest Thompson's play On Golden Pond debuted in 1979 with Tom Aldridge, the jailer from Full Moon High, and Francis Sternhagen, the doctor from Outland, in the lead roles.
Oh. Well, I don't remember the jailer so much, but I do remember the
Sternhagen
doctor.
Sternhagen is great, yeah. It was followed soon after by a revival with an all-African-American cast led by James Earl Jones, who we've had so far as Darth Vader in Empire, and Leslie Uggams, best known as Blind Al in the Deadpool movies. More recently, meaning 2006, it ran again starring Michael Learned and Tom Bosley. The original Broadway run was nominated only for Best Actress. Jane Fonda fell in love with the story, feeling that it closely mirrored her own relationship with actor father Henry Fonda, and quickly snapped up the film rights, though producers did approach Jimmy Stewart to play Norman Thayer, and he declined, opening the door for Henry Fonda to play as his daughter's father.
So it would have still had Jane Fonda in it as that role?
She had the rights to it, and I think she had final say, but producers were very interested in Jimmy Stewart playing this character.
Right, with her as the daughter.
Yeah, and if you had Jimmy Stewart, I would obviously pick Jimmy Stewart over Henry Fonda like 9 out of 10 times.
I feel like it would have been a very different movie, though.
Definitely.
With Jimmy Stewart, because he's just so much more likable, even when he's grumpy.
Even when he's mean, but I feel like this movie needed him to be a little bit more sympathetic than he was.
Oh, 100% it did, because he was just too annoying for me to care about this character.
Right, but we'll get into that. Ingrid Bergman was in talks briefly to star opposite Henry Fonda, but dropped out. Katharine Hepburn was favored for the part, but had suffered a recent tennis injury and was due for surgery. For safety's sake, Barbara Stanwyck was contracted as a standby to fill in if Hepburn didn't feel up to the part by the time production began. Somehow, this slow geriatric drama went on to score the second highest box office of the year.
What?
After Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Why?
Which should have been a huge payday for producer Lou Grade, but he was forced to sell off his own distribution company after the failure of last year's Raise the Titanic, and most of that money went to the new owners. At the Oscars that year, Henry Fonda and Katharine Hepburn were both nominated for lead roles, both won, and neither were in attendance. It was the first time that husband and wife characters in a film have both won lead acting Oscars.
I mean, they didn't do a bad job.
No,
but
they
like,
were great.
Oscar worthy? I mean, I guess maybe what are they up against this year?
Well, we'll talk about that too.
Well, yeah, and also, I mean, they're kind of Hollywood
royalty.
Yeah.
Fonda was the oldest actor to win an Oscar at the time, though the record is currently held by Sir Anthony Hopkins, who was 83 in The Father in 2020. Everybody remembers that movie, right? The Father?
Yeah.
What the hell is that? It was also nominated for Adapted Screenplay, Supporting Actress for Jane, Cinematography, Directing, Editing, Original Score, Sound, and Picture. Henry Fonda held the record for Longest Gap, 41 years between acting nominations for Grapes of Wrath in 1940 and this in 81, but that record was broken this year when Judd Hirsch, who was nominated last season for Ordinary People, was renominated this year for Spielberg's The Fablemans. 43 years.
So just nominated, not nominated and winning.
Correct. And not being nominated any time between the two.
Mm. Interesting.
Hepburn's win bookended the longest gap between first and last Oscar wins, having taken home her first statue 48 years earlier for Morning Glory in 1933.
Wow.
This was also the first time parent and child received nominations for the same film, though it has happened again since, a decade later, for Rambling Rose, starring mother and daughter Diane Ladd and Laura Dern. And obviously, in Paper Moon, we discussed how upset Ryan O'Neill was not to get the nomination. Critics at the time believed Lancaster's turn in Atlantic City was a sure thing, and attributed Fonda's win to his daughter's heavy campaigning efforts because she was an A-lister at the time and mm-hmm. was able to push people to vote for her father.
Yeah, that makes sense.
We start with shots of Golden Pond, a fictional Maine lake. The sun is rising behind it, giving the water a bright orange glow.
I definitely knew nothing about this movie going in.
Right.
And had heard of it previously, but always gotten it confused with Walden Pond. And I always thought this was like some weird Henry David Thoreau, like transcendentalist movie. And I'm like, I don't know what that movie is about, but I think it'd be boring.
I don't know what Walden Pond is.
It was boring, but it wasn't his fault.
Well, Walden Pond's in Boston, isn't it?
I don't know.
I've never even heard of that. But I always just put this in the category with like Bridges of Madison County, like old people near water movies.
And Cocoon.
Yeah.
But that's a pool.
But they're submerging in water and there's aliens. So obviously I saw that one.
a bunch of old people go to space. I hope I didn't ruin anything for you.
A car winds down a road around the water and rolls up to a cabin. Out of it climb Ethel and Norman Thayer, played by Katharine Hepburn and Henry Fonda. Right away, we get a taste of the contrast between Ethel's lust for life and Norman's distaste for it.
The loons. The loons. They're welcoming us back.
I don't hear a thing.
They push into the cabin to find furniture wrapped in blankets because the greatest generation could afford a second house that they kept empty most of the year as a joke. Ethel moves around uncovering things, and Norman leans in close to read all the memorabilia they've wallpapered the place with. It's like a TGI Fridays just for you.
Mm-hmm. Also, exposition dump.
Yeah. Norman steps to the porch, and the screen door falls right out of its frame. He locates a family photo, presumably of himself with his wife and daughter, but he can't recognize the faces and calls out to Ethel to identify these people. He phones the operator to test the cabin's phones, but forgets what he's calling for in the middle of it. He asks them to call him back out of the phone book to make sure it still rings, and they never do.
Someone's at the door.
It's me, you old poop.
It's me, you old poop. I'm not going to talk in her voice the whole time.
No, perfect.
You should.
You can simulate Katharine Hepburn's voice by just shaking a person slowly as they talk.
It's like one of those little cow things. That
was like the Dana Carvey impression. Was that her or was that Margot Kidder? He did one of those impressions really well. Ethel's hands are full of firewood, and when Norman opens the door, she rushes it beside the fireplace.
Firewood? She's not, like, firewood singular, because it's just one giant log.
No, she has a log in one hand and, like
kindling.
A blanket wrapped around a bunch more. She mentions a couple she bumped into while she was collecting wood, and they talk about having dinner together, but we never come back to those people. I keep thinking, like, this is what it's going to be about. Oh, no, okay, this is what it's going to be about.
Have we been separated from her for that long that she's talked to other people?
Been gone for hours and he didn't notice. Like, it does seem like a dementia moment where he's like, oh, someone's at the door, and he didn't notice she's been gone for 3 hours. Ethel finds a childhood toy has fallen from the mantle into the fireplace, and Norman jokes that he must have committed suicide because of a fatal illness like termites. Ethel is already tired of Norman's morbid sense of humor. Later, we see them paddling a canoe across the lake, and we notice a pair of loons in the water, but the moment is interrupted when a motorboat scoots by and scares them away.
And there's a couple of birds in the water, too.
Oh, yeah.
No, these loons are important. It's a metaphor. They are the loons.
This canoe, nicknamed Gertrude, was bought at auction in 2004 by entertainer Wayne Newton.
Oh.
Weird. That night, they play board games.
So they're playing Parcheesi.
Right.
Which is a game that I've always been aware of and it can easily recognize the board. Well, that's a Parcheesi board, but I've never played the game in my life.
I don't think I have either. It just looks exactly like Sorry to me, though.
Yeah, except they just shout out random numbers and they're like, 15, 20, I'm here now.
So you're saying it's a fake game. You're saying people are pretending to play Parcheesi every time they play Parcheesi.
Yeah.
15, 20. That's how I feel watching tennis. It's like, those numbers don't add up to what you just did.
Yeah, just add one. Why does that have to be a series of 15s?
Yeah, but it's not even just 15s either. It's like 15, 30, 40. What? Wait.
25, love. What? Love isn't even a factor here.
Well, you're not playing it right. Your heart's not in it. The next day, they take their own motorboat to the gas station, and the kids running the place have a little fun at Norman's expense, and he isn't having it.
That'll be $38, please, Mr. Thayer.
Yeah. You know how much gasoline costs when I was your age? 12 cents a gallon.
Is that a fact? I didn't even know they had gas back then.
What are you, a couple of nitwits? Think it's funny being old?
Back at the cabin, Ethel is locked out again because her hands are full of strawberry buckets. She's annoyed that Norman doesn't want to leave the house. As revenge, she shoves this 80-year-old man out into the woods with a bucket and tells him to bend over and pick strawberries off the ground. I am half this dude's age, and if Jesse told me to go pick strawberries, I would go buy some at the store.
I picked these out.
Yeah.
I'm not even mad. I got strawberries.
I found a giant strawberry tree at the store.
Tree?
Tree.
They grow on the ground. We've already established you got to bend over.
They're small trees. The mailman, Charlie, pulls up his boat, and Ethel invites him inside. Out in the woods, Norman is quickly lost and starts hyperventilating. When he finally makes it back to the cabin, Ethel mocks his empty strawberry buckets. Norman blames Charlie for the broken screen door.
I like that he tries to, like, downplay that he didn't get any strawberries. No, no, I'll just mix them in with yours.
Yeah, she takes the bucket. She's like, no, there's nothing in here. I must have eaten them all. Ethel tries to read Norman a letter from their daughter, but he distracts himself with the sports pages.
I got a letter from Chelsea.
Look at the goddamn Orioles. Baltimore's always been a sneaky town.
Evidently, Chelsea is coming for Norman's upcoming birthday party and bringing along her new dentist boyfriend. Mailman Charlie asks what happened between Chelsea and her ex-husband, and Ethel leaves it at, it didn't work out.
Why didn't you marry Chelsea?
Well, you wouldn't let me.
Huh?
Charlie tells Norman that Miss Apley, a woman from town, recently passed away at 97 years old. Norman fills in Ethel on the gossip with his own choice of words.
What's so funny?
One of the lesbians expired.
Oh. No. Which one, Tommy?
Miss Apley.
I didn't know anything about this movie except that it was about a geriatric couple on a lake, and from here on, I assumed that Ethel was misreading the letter and Chelsea was going to show up with a girlfriend, which is definitely how this movie would go if it were remade today. When Charlie leaves, Norman finally admits to getting lost in the woods. He's nearly in tears as she consoles him on the porch. She asks him to please not take out his frustrations on Chelsea when she arrives. That night, Ethel is warbling into the darkness to converse with the loons. She notices Norman on the balcony wearing a bow tie and worries she's underdressed, so he offers her another bow tie. Inside the cabin, he's a bit annoyed to see his party decorated with a Welcome Home Chelsea banner. She begs him again to let them be friendly.
It's like when your brother Mikey gets a happy St. Patrick's Day on his birthday.
Right, and it says, Aunt Mikey. It's like, Aunt Mikey what? Fuck you guys. St. Mikey Day? When Chelsea arrives, played by Henry's daughter, Jane Fonda, she mentions they rented a car to drive out here, but she can't remember the make or model. Before introducing her boyfriend, she introduces his son, Bill Jr.
You seem awfully young to be a dentist.
This is Billy Ray Jr.
The kid hits Norman right where it hurts.
I hear you turned 80 today.
Is that what you heard?
Yeah. Man, that's really old.
You should meet my father.
Your father's still alive?
Nah, but you should meet him.
Bill Sr. steps in shortly after, played by Dabney Coleman. Norman is digging into the man almost immediately when Ethel, Chelsea, and Bill Jr. head outside to say hello to the lake, leaving Bill Sr. and Norman to chat.
I think this movie needed more Dabney Coleman.
I don't disagree.
But I think that every movie does.
That's probably true, too. Dad plays hard to get and does his best to turn every sentence he utters into an insult.
I love your house. How are you? It's not for sale.
Well, how does it feel to turn 80?
Twice as bad as it did turning 40.
Norman learns from Bill Sr. that Bill Jr. hasn't read Treasure Island, and he considers it an outrage. Bill Sr. decides on a bizarre approach to defuse the old curmudgeon. He asks if it's okay for him to sleep with Norman's daughter while they're here.
Norman, we'd like to sleep together if it's all right with you.
What do you mean?
Why would you ask it like that?
Yeah.
Not that this was even worth bringing up, but just say, do you care if we share a room?
Right. Yeah.
Leave it at that.
Right.
I guess I'd be delighted to have you abuse my daughter under my own roof. Would you like the room where I first violated her mother? Or would you be interested in the master bedroom? Ethel and your boy and I could sleep out back. You could do it right here on the hearth. Like that idea?
Luckily, Bill Sr. was prepared for this kind of behavior, and he lets Norman know that he won't put up with being treated this way all weekend.
I was like, yeah, stand up for yourself, Dabney Coleman.
Yeah. Bill Jr. pops into the cabin to tell Dad that mother and daughter are skinny dipping, and Sr. tells Jr. to wait inside with Norman while he joins the ladies of the lake.
Which is also weird. Go see your girlfriend's mom nude in the lake.
Yeah.
Weird.
Hot.
And everybody's okay with this.
Jr. and Norman talk a bit until Norman hands the kid a copy of Treasure Island and demands a report on Chapter 1 by morning. Ethel returns from the swim and shares with Norman that Chelsea has asked the favor of them watching Billy Jr. for the next month while they're away. Norman agrees to the favor.
Yeah, I thought that this was going to be like a very harsh resistance moment.
Yeah.
And he's like, yeah, okay.
I think it would have been a resistance if he were enjoying this trip, but he's already not. So it's like, who fucking cares if there's another person here? I don't want to listen to people complain that I said no.
I think it's weird on Chelsea's behalf, mostly. She has...
Well, we understand later why they're leaving the kid here.
But she has a strained relationship with her father and, you know, considers him at least mentally abusive to her.
Yeah.
Why would you leave a child with him?
Because you barely know this kid. it's not her kid. It's his
kid. Doesn't matter. Like, don't leave another human with this man that you find abusive.
I mean, yeah, that's true.
It's like the mother gets to make that choice, but she can't. She's choosing to subject this kid to this. Like, does he not have friends? Just leave him at a friend's house.
This is a friend's house now. It becomes one. We cut to later that night as Ethel carries in a cake with 80 candles, I assume. I didn't count them.
There's a lot.
Norman doesn't have much of a speech prepared, and they all blow them out together, the candles. What else could that possibly have meant? Charlie arrives the next day with the mail, and he's happy to find Chelsea here with her family. Bill Sr. puts a foot on the man's boat to lean over and ask a question, and the boat keeps drifting away from the dock until Bill falls in the water, and everybody laughs about it. It's a fun little moment. We're having fun here. I think the saddest thing about the existence of cell phones is that water isn't funny to fall in anymore. You used to be able to fall in water and everyone could be like, but now it's like, oh, fuck. His key is his phone.
Just, that just cost you $800.
Yeah.
$800?
Yeah, $800 for the key fob. And then another $2,000 for the phone.
Yeah, my iPhone is considerably more.
Now that's your own fault.
I know.
Buying a stupid iPhone.
Might as well get a degree in something.
They're both as useless.
Actually, a phone is very useful compared to a college degree. That night, they all play more Parcheesi except Chelsea, and we get hints in the conversation that her dad took the game too seriously in the past and put her off board games in general.
You seem to like beating people. I wonder why.
Implying a history of abuse, potentially physical, which does raise the question. Why leave a kid in this old man's hands?
Don't subject anyone to this.
He doesn't notice when people are leaving the room. Why would he stop hitting this child?
What?
he's a confused old man.
Right, right. Like, so
he thinks Bill is Chelsea sometimes. Of course he's going to hit this kid. The next day, Chelsea tries to explain why she always shrinks to the personality of a little girl around her father, but Ethel seems deliberately obtuse. Ethel comes to Norman's defense, as is her custom, and tells Chelsea that it's her own fault that she doesn't get along with her father.
Yeah.
You have a great big chip on your shoulder, which is very unattractive. It is. It is. You stay away for years at a time. You never come home unless I beg you to, and then when you do, all you can do is be disagreeable about the past. What's the point?
It's a fun twist to learn that both of her parents are shitty and deserve to die alone here in the cabin.
my note is Ethel gives Chelsea terrible advice.
Yeah. Fuck this lady. Instead of apologizing for it and condemning her husband for his continued abuse, Ethel tells Chelsea that her child trauma is boring and she should find something more interesting to talk about. Bar, bar, bar. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Boa, boa, boa.
Chelsea and Bill Sr. pack up the car to leave Junior behind, and in their first moment alone together, Junior tells the old folks that he's not going to put up with their shit. Ethel announces they'll be fishing today, and Junior is immediately disinterested. Digging through the fishing equipment, Norman shows Junior some of Chelsea's old stuff.
Surprised he still kept it if it's Chelsea's.
Junior's already picking up on Norman's hatred for his own daughter. Junior eventually agrees to join them on the fishing trip, and he's startled by the speed of their motorboat.
Yeah, motorboat and son of a bitch.
Are they built for speed or comfort? Later in the day, Norman challenges Junior to do a backflip off the dock into the water. What he manages is more of a backflop.
Ouch! Good God.
That wasn't it.
Thanks for telling me.
Norman, we've got him for a whole month. Don't kill him the first week.
Norman finds an acceptable fishing spot and they get started. Norman shares with Billy Jr. that there's a 10-pound trout in these waters and he's nearly caught it once before. Norman has named it Walter. He raises his voice to the boy quickly for some minor infraction, and Junior is quick to defend himself and tell Norman off. Surprisingly, the old man apologizes.
Yeah, like Jesse, I had not seen this movie. And so every time I think that there's going to be a huge conflict, it's always like put
diffused
down.
Immediately.
Yeah. I was like, oh boy, is somebody going to, like, is he, he's growing too fast.
Yeah.
His arc is happening too fast.
Junior lies that he's having fun.
Cruising chicks, isn't it?
No.
Suppose not.
Ethel pulls up to them in a second boat to deliver lunches, and they seem annoyed to be interrupted.
I was like, how many boats do they have?
As many houses as they have. One per house. There are other houses on the other side of the lake. By nightfall, they've caught a dozen fish, and they're gutting them on the porch when Junior asks how Norman and Ethel met. Technically, Norman's making Junior gut all the fish by himself, and when Ethel asks them to start a fire in the fireplace, he puts the kid in charge of that, too, until Ethel reminds him that Junior is not a slave, but a guest.
Norman, for Pete's sake, Billy doesn't have to do all your chores.
What's the point in having a dwarf if he doesn't do chores?
Junior notices he's using the match backward and offers to help with the fire, but Norman shoos him away. As a result, the fire spreads to piles of paper just outside the fireplace, and Ethel thinks the cabin's gonna burn down. Junior dumps the buckets of fish, and mostly water, onto the flames to put them out. Ethel is still congratulating him when Norman complains he's wasted all their fish.
For God's sake, you made a hell of a mess.
What? Norman, he just...
Don't yell at me, man.
It dawns on Norman that he's the problem here, but he still lashes out defensively at the kid.
What are you staring at me for, you little son of a bitch?
Sometime later, Ethel steps in to condone Norman's behavior and make excuses for the man again. Textbook enabling.
He wasn't yelling at you, you know.
Sounds like he is yelling at you.
No, he was yelling at life.
She tells Junior it's his fault for not seeing the good in Norman. What she should be doing is pulling Norman aside and warning him that treating this kid like Chelsea will make him scared of them the way Chelsea is. The next day, Junior asks permission to take Norman's boat out for a spin, and it is granted reluctantly. We see the kid racing around on the water for a while, uneventfully. I was really hoping something would happen here.
Yeah, I was hoping the thing that happens later would happen now.
Yeah. The music for this sequence, though, is probably the strongest bit of the score so far. I really like the music when he's just playing around in the water. Sometime later, the boys prepare for another fishing trip, and Junior surprises Ethel with a fixed screen door. Out on the lake, Norman points their boat into Purgatory Cove, which is a very shallow area with rocks jutting out of the water. To avoid them, he stations Junior on the bow to point them out as they cut through it. They manage their way into the cove in the dark and begin fishing. Norman comments on the encroaching darkness and accidentally calls Junior Chelsea. Junior tries to change the subject.
Hey, we better hurry up and catch Walter, huh? I mean, I'm not going to be here much longer.
Neither am I.
I'll miss you, Norman.
What?
Suddenly, Junior has a heavy tug on his line, and when he finally reels it in, it's a dead loon in the water. Presumably a portent of doom, but they just toss it back and keep fishing. Junior is weirdly hesitant to drop the bird back in the water, almost like he expects they would just gut it with the fish later. It's like, this has been dead for a week.
Yeah.
When another silence settles, Junior asks Norman if he fears death. Norman utilizes a tactic we've seen a lot in the film. When he's asked a question he doesn't want to answer, he says, "What?" in a grumpy way, as if to suggest the asker not repeat the question, or at least reconsider asking again. Junior doesn't care enough not to repeat himself, and so Norman is forced to answer. On the return trip out of the cove, Norman takes spotter duty, and Junior is in charge of steering. After some steady progress, the score turns ominous, and they get hooked on something. Norman orders full throttle reverse, but Junior accidentally blasts forward and crashes hard into a rock, sending Norman ass over kettle into the water. This boat was so rigidly made that on set it bounced harmlessly off the rocks every time, so they had to outfit it with small explosives to blast the hole we see in the boat. Junior dives into the water to collect Norman and drag him to a nearby rock sticking out of the water. The boat sinks away out of view, and the two cling to the rock in the darkness and await rescue. Sometime later, Ethel commandeers Charlie and his boat to go find the missing fishers. Ethel plays spotter on the bow, but Charlie doesn't even want to take his boat through the rocky water. Eventually, they locate the two still clinging snugly to the rock. Ethel dives into the water to swim to them, and it's actually Hepburn doing her own diving here.
It looked like her, and yeah. So I was really surprised after you said that she had to have surgery. I'm like, that's pretty active stunt for
surgery. Yeah, and you can see rocks in this water. She's diving into shallow, rocky water.
That was my big thing. It was like, we just talked about how this is like shallow, dangerous water.
Yeah. A week later, it appears Norman and Junior have been grounded from fishing, and when Ethel announces she's headed out to forage for mushrooms, the second she's out the door, they grab their fishing shit and run for the boat, but she catches them on the way. She reluctantly approves the fishing, but demands they stay within the closest cove. We cut to Chelsea coming down the road without Bill Sr., and she overhears her mother singing and dancing as she collects flowers in the woods.
Here, but we won't be long. There will soon be deer where them now are fawns. But we'll remember our years on Golden Pond.
On Golden Pond. How?
Hey!
Chelsea made a point to memorize the make and model of her car rental this time. Ethel points out the boys fishing way out in the water, and Chelsea is visibly jealous. Ethel says Bill Jr. has been a joy and really brought Norman out of his mood.
Why wasn't that old son of a bitch ever my friend?
You're sounding very childish. Of course he was your friend. He's your father.
Chelsea tries to change the subject by announcing that she and Bill got married in Brussels during their vacation. She's scared to tell Norman because she wants him to be excited and proud for her, and Ethel starts preemptively apologizing for her shitty husband's upcoming lack of enthusiasm.
And you know why? Because he doesn't care. He is a selfish son of a bitch.
That old son of a bitch happens to be my husband.
Chelsea runs down to the water and dives right in. On the water, Junior gets a tug at his line, and seems convinced that this is the monster trout, Walter, but Norman assumes the boy's exaggerating at first. Once he gets the fish to the surface, Norman is shocked.
Good God! It's Walter! What the hell are you doing here, you son of a bitch?
Ethel walks down to the edge of the lake to continue defending her monster husband, insisting he's actually a wonderful person, trapped in a shitty person.
I know he'd walk through fire for me. And he'd walk through fire for you, too. And if you don't understand that, you're not looking closely enough.
Because it's actually Chelsea's fault that she thinks her father is a jerk. A great way to test Ethel's theory would be to set a room on fire earlier in the film and have Norman save the day. But when that happened earlier, he just sat there watching the flames and Bill Jr. took action. So he wouldn't walk through fire for anybody. He would just stare at fire for anybody. Norman is an irredeemable jerk, and Ethel is either in denial or supremely embarrassed about who she decided to waste her entire life with. The boys return on their boat with only the story of Walter because they tossed him back in the lake. Bill rushes off to the cabin, leaving Chelsea and Norman alone. She tries to be as vulnerable as she can with him, wishing out loud they could be friends, and Norman's response is characteristically shitty.
Just in the nick of time, huh? Worried about the will, are you? Well, I'm leaving everything to you except what I'm taking with me.
In reality, Henry Fonda left nothing to his biological children, Jane, Peter, or Francis, splitting his fortune between his wife at the time of his death and an adoptive daughter from his third marriage. She promises to come around more often if he's willing to treat her with respect, though she pretends she has changing to do as well. Because of their very similar real-life relationship, a lot of the crying here is supposedly authentic.
Well, his response to this, too, is like, your mother would like it if you came around.
Right, yeah.
Yeah.
What an asshole.
Which, in any other movie, I would assume is like, he's too macho to admit that he would care too, but I don't think this guy cares. Yeah. I think he fucking hates his daughter. When she announces her wedding to Bill Sr., Norman feigns excitement, so much so that Chelsea is confused by what he's even trying to say.
I'm glad, Chelsea. That's Sam Fantastic.
What?
Like, she literally doesn't even understand him. He tells her that Bill Jr. actually figured out backflips while she was gone, and she takes it as a personal criticism since she never mastered the backflip as a child.
Oh, that's right. You never were a great backflipper, were you?
I was always too fat, remember?
Yeah, I do remember that now. What a dick.
Yeah, I do remember that now.
What was I laughing about? Oh, yes, that crippled Irishman.
To get past it, she decides it's not too late to master the backflip. She climbs up onto the diving board at the end of the dock and successfully, in quotes, backflips into the water. She flubs it pretty good. But this is actually Jane Fonda doing her own stunt here, because Katharine Hepburn was like, you're going to do your own stunt, right? Because I dove off of a boat into the water. So she was like, all right, fuck it, I guess. Norman stands to applaud and expresses the closest thing we've seen to genuine pride. Chelsea and Bill Jr. pack up the car to leave, and Norman drops one of his college diving medals over her head. The groups part on relatively pleasant terms, and Chelsea even gets a big hug from Norman on the way out. Sometime later, Ethel and Norman are packing up their stuff, and a heavy box of china proves beyond Norman's lifting abilities. He's worked himself into a heart attack and drops the plates in the doorway before collapsing on the porch. Ethel gets his nitroglycerin and tucks it under his tongue, begging him to survive whatever this is. She tries to phone a doctor, but the operator is taking their time responding. He tries over and over to tell her something.
Yes, Norman, my darling.
Ethel.
Yes, I'm here, Norman.
Ethel.
Yes, yes, yes.
Ethel.
What is it, Norman?
I think I'm feeling all right now.
That's right, Norman's fine. What a tease.
He needed to die like that
loon. He really needed to die here.
Yeah, well, what was the point of the loon death? Right. What was this?
The phone finally rings and it's like, oh, the operator got back to us. Oh, no, Jane Fonda died on her way down the hill. They step out on a deck over the water to say goodbye to the lake, and the camera pans across the water to the horizon as the sun sets and credits roll. But the credits roll in this weird, obnoxious way where the camera is slowly tilting down over the lake and the text keeps pace with the background as it's very disorienting to look at. And that's the end of the film. That's On Golden Pond. It's pretty boring. The personal story is what makes it at all watchable. The fact that I believe that these two hated each other.
I mean, I guess I assumed that there was a personal relationship that caused them to make this movie in that way, but I didn't know the backstory when I watched it. But no character in this, except maybe Billy Jr., is responding to anybody.
Both of the Bills
in a way. Well, but he's just in it for like 5 seconds. Responding to anybody in a way that I appreciate. Like, I'm just like... I don't even like how Chelsea does things. Like, every few seconds, she's still trying to win her father back up until the end.
That's true. Yeah. If I were Chelsea, I wouldn't be in this movie.
Nobody changes here. Yeah. I mean, you think that Henry Fonda's name in this movie is
Norman.
You think that Norman changes, but he really doesn't.
No, Norman's change is literally for a couple scenes because he knows he'll get in trouble and it will be a big argument if he doesn't pretend to care that she got married and give her an award for diving off of a dock. Like, he doesn't care about that.
Yeah, so
he's just like, here, please shut up.
Yeah, I don't think that anybody is redeemable in this movie.
Yeah. No, I especially can't stand Norman and Ethel, though. Like, the two of them are just nightmare people.
Well, I didn't have quite the intensive reaction. I agree on most points. I found the movie to be fine. I watched it and I was like, okay.
Yeah.
I don't get why this is Best Picture. I don't get why this is,
I mean,
is
it was
like,
only a nomination.
No,
and,
but...
And it's Hollywood royalty in the
play
adaptation.
It's like on Golden Pond. You're just like, oh, nominated for Best Picture. It's like, oh, this must be a really amazing movie. I was like, it's fine.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Like, it's very Oscar baity.
Yeah. I really wanted more of a change. Like, I really wanted Norman to be really resistant to the kid.
Yeah.
Like, not... Because, like, the kid says it's bullshit. And he's like, oh, you like that word, huh? Oh, that's a pretty good word. It's like, he's so accommodating Like,
yeah, and it almost makes it seem like the point of the story is that he's just sexist.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if she had been a boy,
right,
he would have been this nice for their entire relationship. But because she was born a girl, he was just like, I can't relate to you as a human. Mm-hmm. Get the fuck out of my life.
I do not understand all of that. but yeah, he doesn't change. No one changes. Like, it's a little sweet with, like, the relationship with the kid. Like,
Between Norman and the kid?
Yeah. But I disagree, because I feel like by the end, the only thing that has happened is the kid has picked up some of his mannerisms.
Mm.
I think mostly the kid likes fishing. That's what this movie is about.
Yeah.
Like, the kid doesn't even like Norman. The kid just likes fishing. And he's like, this guy will take me fishing.
Yeah.
I like literally anyone who will take me fishing.
I think he uses a couple of his, like, by the end, he's calling, you know, things a son of a bitch, like, you know, Norman.
Or when
does,
he gets thrown into the water and he's like, oh, God.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I think that the kid is worse off at the end of this movie, and he's the only one that changed it all.
Yeah. On the way home, he's just like, hey, Chelsea, you look like a fat little girl. That's On Golden Pond, everybody. A lot of nominations. I think it's still a thumbs up because it's these two huge Hollywood names for their last films.
Fine. I'll be bold. I'm giving it a thumbs down.
Okay. That's fair. Uh-huh. I don't criticize that at all.
I give it a thumbs up, but it's because I just think it's fine.
Yeah. What are we doing Letterboxd?
It's not great.
Yeah, this is gonna be real interesting.
I have it at 89 out of 165. No, 98. I'm dyslexic. It's at 98. It is below Carbon Copy and above Modern Romance.
Okay. That's wrong, but good.
I have it at 58, which puts it below Only When I Laugh, but above American Pop.
All right. I have it at 100 out of 165, you said. That's right under Winter of Our Dreams and just above Watcher in the Woods.
Another. Watcher in the Woods is real low.
But at least Watcher in the Woods had a cool monster at the end.
Well, in the one deleted version. Scene.
Yeah, but that's still better than this.
Yeah. If we were counting the deleted scene with a crazy monster in this one, he pulls Walter out and it's actually a 100-pound demon.
Oh, yeah. So much better.
That'd be great. Our director here was Mark Rydell. We just had him as Jewish gangster Marty Augustine in The Long Goodbye. Before this, he directed The Fox, The Reavers, and The Cowboys. He later directs the James Dean TV movie with James Franco. The writer here was Ernest Thompson. He wrote the screenplay and the play. In 2001, he directed a TV movie version of the film with Julie Andrews and Christopher Plummer. I think I could stand watching that one.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get why that, you know, but that's like the whole thing. It's like, oh, they are reunited.
Yeah. That's the Sound of Music peoples. He also acts occasionally, including a part in Star 80, the story of Dorothy Stratton's murder. The music here was from Dave Grusin. He also composed The Pursuit of Happiness in 71, Fuzz, The Friends of Eddie Coyle, The Yakuza, The Goodbye Girl, Heaven Can Wait, and The Champ. So far on the show, he has composed 3 Days of the Condor and My Bodyguard, and he's back later this season with Absence of Malice. The cinematographer was Billy Williams. He previously lit Sunday Bloody Sunday, X, Y, and Z, The Silent Partner, and Going in Style. So far on the show, we've seen his work in Saturn 3. Later, he lights Gandhi and The Manhattan Project. The editor here was Robert L. Wolfe. He also cut The Getaway, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, The Terminal, The Wind and the Lion, All the President's Men, and Big Wednesday. So far on the show, he's cut The Hunter, and this is his final credit. He actually passed away before its release, and the film is dedicated to his memory. He was awarded a posthumous Oscar nomination for his work here. Katharine Hepburn played Ethel Thayer. She's a 4-time Oscar-winning actress for Morning Glory in 34, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner in 68, The Lion in Winter in 69, and this, with 12 acting nominations overall. She also has memorable turns in Bringing Up Baby, The Philadelphia Story, and The African Queen. She's known for her regular collaborations with partner Spencer Tracy, and she was played in Scorsese's The Aviator by Cate Blanchett. Henry Fonda played Norman Thayer Jr. He was awarded an honorary Oscar the year before, and he won his first competitive Oscar for this film. He was also nominated for his turns in The Grapes of Wrath and 12 Angry Men.
Like, I feel like you get an honorary Oscar when you've had a long body of career right. and no Oscar wins.
Yeah, and so then you like, win it the next year.
It's like we're taking that honorary one back.
Yeah, and that happened again later in the same decade. I'm trying to remember. I think, who was it?
Well, I know Peter O'Toole got one, but was nominated for Venus, but I don't think he won for Venus.
No, it was in the 80s.
Oh.
Within a few years of this, that someone got an honorary Oscar and then the next year picked up their first official acting win, but I'm blanking on who it was.
So I've probably only seen Henry Fonda in one or two movies. I have to admit, I haven't seen much of his work. It's obviously much older work.
Yeah.
Is he a good actor?
He's great in 12 Angry Men.
And I really like him in Mr. Roberts.
Okay. I just, in this movie, he feels like a cartoon caricature of what an old grumpy old man is supposed
yeah,
to be like.
He does.
But not in a funny way, like in a...
But you know what? I think it's a very accurate cartoon because I feel like this was not super different from how he normally is.
Well, maybe it's not. Maybe that's just how he acts. But it just felt...
A little exaggerated?
It felt over the top to me. Yeah. And so I'm just curious if in general he's a good actor or not.
Yeah, I can't say that for certain. I mean, he's a respected actor and he worked for a long time. So that's all I can point to.
Hmm.
Jane Fonda played Chelsea Thayer Wayne. She was Cat Ballou in Cat Ballou. She was Corey Bratter in Barefoot in the Park, Barbarella in Barbarella, and Gloria in They Shoot Horses, Don't They? She's also in Fun with Dick and Jane and the China Syndrome. So far, we've seen her in 9 to 5, and she's back soon for Rollover. Out of 7 acting nominations, she has won 2 Oscars for Clute and Coming Home. Her most recent credit is as Grandmama in Ruby Gilman Teenage Kraken. This is her only film appearance alongside her father. Doug McKeon played Billy Ray. Not many credits I recognize. That's the kid.
Yeah.
But he does have some other stuff, but not a lot of big titles. Dabney Coleman played Bill Ray Sr. We've seen him already in Nothing Personal, How to Beat the High Cost of Living, Melvin and Howard, and 9 to 5, also with Jane Fonda, which is why she brought him back for this. Later, he'll show up in Cloak and Dagger, Man with One Red Shoe, War Games, and Clifford. Christopher Rydell played Sumner Todd. Not much I recognize, but he is the son of director Mark Rydell. And Troy Garrity played Young Boy on Jetty. He's got lots of... Actually, you know what? I screwed up before. The kid at the gas station is Sumner Todd. So that's Christopher Rydell. That's the director's kid, not Henry Fonda's grandson.
Hmm.
Troy Garrity plays Young Boy on Jetty. He has lots of TV work lately, including a 47 run as Jason on Ballers. He's also the son of Jane Fonda and grandson of Henry Fonda, and later he appeared in Bandits with Cate Blanchett, who played his mother in Aviator. I think that's everything for On Golden Pond. If you have any thoughts you'd like to share, you can find all our socials at linktree.com/vintagevideopod. Because this is our first episode of the month again, I wanted to remind our listeners about our Patreon campaign. We will always be free, but if it's worth it to you, $5 patrons get a shout out on the show, a monthly exclusive episode reviewing a title from the 70s, and a hand in choosing each month's film. Joining now unlocks 43 full-size 70s reviews, and for August of 1973, our $5 patrons are choosing between the following 6 titles. Beyond Atlantis, Eddie Romero's action-adventure film about treasure hunters making landfall on an uncharted island and clashing with the natives over their sacred prize. It stars Patrick Wayne, John Ashley, Lee Christian, and Sid Haig. Day for Night, François Truffaut's comedy drama about a director struggling to wrap a film and the drama unfolding behind the scenes. It stars Jacqueline Bisset, Valentina Cortese, Danny, and Alexandra Stewart. From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, Fielder Cook's adaptation of E.L. Konigsberg's beloved novel about brother and sister Jamie and Claudia who run away from home to camp out in New York's Metropolitan Museum.
I loved that book.
Yeah, I did too. I never saw any adaptation.
I didn't know it was a movie either.
Hit, Sidney J. Furie's crime film about a federal agent avenging his daughter's death by heroin overdose by tearing down a local drug ring. Kid Blue, James Frawley's Western comedy about a young train robber trying to go straight at the dwindling end of the Wild West. It stars Dennis Hopper, Warren Oates, Peter Boyle, and Ben Johnson. And finally, The Slams, Jonathan Kaplan's crime film about imprisoned thief Curtis X. Hook and all the people out to discover his hidden nest egg of stolen cash on the outside. It stars Jim Brown, Judy Pace, Roland Bob Harris, and Paul Harris, each of which celebrate their 50th anniversaries in the month of September. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you'll join us next time when we'll be discussing Buddy Buddy, which IMDb describes like so. During a high-profile mafia testimony case in California's Riverside County, a hired killer checks into a hotel room near the courthouse while his depressed next-door neighbor wants to commit suicide due to marital problems. We leave you now with the trailer for Buddy Buddy. It's another Jack Lemmon trying to kill himself movie. I think there's three of these.
Yeah.
This is the story of two men who met on the off-ramp of the highway of life.
Sorry, I was throwing up. I had a nervous stomach because of my wife. We're separated. 3 months this Thursday.
Jack Lemmon is Victor Clooney.
We've been together for 12 years.
That long?
He only wants to die.
Now, the whole thing is in my suicide note. You want to read it?
No.
Walter Matthau is a mailman. A milkman. A hitman.
Oh, my God. What line of work are you in?
Pest control.
They met by coincidence, became friends.
Come on back. I promise not to tie you up again.
By accident.
Oh, it is a lucky thing I wound up next door to you. You know what they say? The kindness of strangers.
But stay together by necessity.
What have I done to deserve this?
And survive by mistake.
Let me do the job.
You?
Yeah, I have nothing to lose. Besides, I owe you one.
What are you gonna do? Walk across the street and throw up all over him?
They were eternal friends for an hour and a half.
You just may be the nicest person that ever lived.
I don't have to stand here listening to that kind of talk.
Now, maybe they had their little disagreements. I'm sure the road got a little bumpy. And sometimes life got a little hairy.
Wait a minute!
But what's a little murder between friends?
Nope.
Jack and Walter in the most arresting comedy of the year.
Have I done something to offend you?
Buddy Buddy, the original odd couple, together again.